WBCA Radio is proud to present City Talk, where fascinating conversation is alive and well, with your host, Boston radio veteran Ken Meyer.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to a unique edition, I think, of City Talk. All kinds of books have been written, and the author of one of them is here with us in studio. The book is called Carry On, A Story of Resilience and Redemption. And the author, Lisa Finn, is sitting here with us to discuss a rather unique book. And Lisa, why don't you tell us, give us a synopsis of the book, and then we'll go right back to the beginning.
Sure. Well, to speak in broad strokes, the book is about the unlikely intersection of three lives, three people of different ages, cultures, experiences, spiritual beliefs, races, ability levels, and it chronicles what happens at the intersection of those three lives.
All right, let's start with you. You are from Ohio, and you were from a sports family to begin with.
Yes, that's true. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio in the 70s and 80s. My grandfather was a sports editor for what was the Cleveland Press and Cleveland Plain Dealer. Sports was always the hot topic of conversation around our house. We spent summers going to Indians games, and spring trainings in Arizona was our family vacation. Sundays were spent watching the Browns, and sports was definitely the focal point.
I can remember going to a wedding in Cleveland, as a matter of fact. And that night, it was still in Municipal Stadium, and we just walked up to the window and wound up with terrific seats with the Yankees in Cleveland. But we had gorgeous seats, and it was like an hour before the game.
Yes, well, there are great benefits to living in a town with a losing sports team. You can always get a good ticket. My cousins and I would go home with armfuls of foul balls because there was so many gaps between seats. You were always guaranteed to chase one down. No problems getting player autographs. There are benefits to living in a city with a losing team.
I can remember when Rocky Colavito played with Cleveland and got traded to Detroit for Harvey Keene in 1960. I'll never forget that.
My father's still grieving.
And and the sports writer whose name I remember very well in Cleveland is Gordon Kobeldick. I don't know why I remember that name, but that name sticks in my head.
Sounds like a hard one to forget.
But I've always liked Cleveland, and they have good broadcasters. And it's a great city. Now, it was your dad who tipped you off to these two young gentlemen, one who had no legs and another one who had partial eyesight. But before we get to that, you made two choices to try and get a job, either with ESPN or the CIA. I mean, I can't think of more two different areas of work than that. How did you decide on the? I mean, ESPN, I can understand because I'm a sports fan too. But the CIA?
Yeah, I had graduated from Cornell University in '97 and left with had a great experience, but no clear direction as to where I wanted to go and what type of work I wanted to do. My father was quite panicked after spending so much on a degree for me. And as I explored what I might like to do in those days, there was no online job applications. You went through the classified ads in the newspaper on Sundays. And I had applied for a production assistant job through ESPN. And then I came across a classified ad for CIA recruitment. And I said, oh, just maybe I should do that. And my dad said they would never in a million years take someone like you. And he's right, I thought, because I was not the bravest, most adventurous child, but we also had a relationship where if he said I couldn't do something, then that was the first thing I wanted to do. And so I applied, and much to both of our surprises, got a phone call inviting me to interview and went through many rounds of interviews for the CIA while I was working at ESPN. and sort of trying to figure out if I was going to live a life cheering out loud in sports or a life undetected in the CIA.
I'm always interested in job interviews and interview techniques. And your interview with ESPN was rather strange, to say the least. Tell us about that.
It does seem strange, but it turns out it was perfectly routine for ESPN during that time period. My interview to enter the production field was essentially a 10-question sports trivia quiz. And I'm not, I love sports. I love the passion of them. I love live sporting events. I love playing them, but I'm not a sports trivia buff. And so I very quickly failed that test. I'm not even sure I got one correct. And at the end of it, the interviewer said, thank you for coming. If we're interested, we'll give you a call unless there's anything else you'd like to say, which was my last chance. And so I said, well, there is something I'd like to say. I know I've failed your test, so you likely won't be calling. But what your test doesn't tell you is what type of communication skills I have, with my creativity, my people skills. Those are things missing in that test. And he just sort of listened, and then he said, can you start in 2 weeks?
I like that
and,
part.
Yeah, it was a little more fiery of a retort by me than I'm conveying right now. But he said in the end that people with spunk do well in this business, and he would give me a chance. And so that's how I got in the door.
Sounds like the line that was in the first Lou Grant show with Mary Tyler Moore, and he said, you got spunk.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, something like that. And I thought of that when I read that. I said, oh, that's the first thing that popped into my head.
It was a very intimidating interview, I have to say. He was a seasoned veteran. There wasn't any small talk or room for grace.
But you started at the bottom, but still had a good time.
Yeah, I loved working there. I always say it kind of felt like a fraternity party, but without alcohol. It was just all sports all the time. You know, working late nights because that's when sports are happening. And people who are in the sports field are just naturally very passionate, very entertaining, very engaged. And I loved it.
All right. You devote one chapter to three stories that you covered. One of them is involving a gentleman who was here in Massachusetts named Travis Roy. But tell us about that story and the other two that you worked on before you got involved with the two gentlemen that you wrote the book about.
Sure. I met Travis Roy in the mid-2000s, and I was assigned to do a feature story for SportsCenter on the 10-year anniversary of his accident. Most in Boston are familiar with what happened to him, but for those who are not, he was a highly touted prospect, a freshman at Boston University and a hockey player, and 11 seconds into his first game, he fell awkwardly headfirst into the boards and was rendered a quadriplegic. So I met him 10 years later when I was assigned to do a commemorative feature, and it was lovely. We just struck up a really deep friendship that has continued today. We're coming up on the 25th anniversary of that accident, and Travis has demonstrated resilience in the best possible sense of that word, how he's dedicated his life now to raising money to provide adaptive equipment to other spinal cord injury victims. And obviously he would do anything to have his mobility back, but he's making the best of what he has today.
And there were some very moving questions when he was interviewed that you talk about in that chapter as well.
Yeah, I remember that. I don't remember the chapter in detail, but I do remember the interview because he had been interviewed so many times over 10 years, particularly after his accident. And one of the challenges in interviewing people who have been interviewed before, is coming up with fresh ways to look at an old story and questions to help them examine their journey in new ways. And I remember I was working with Tom Rinaldi, and his first question to Travis was, when you dream in your sleep, what do you see? And Travis...
I've been asked that question, as a matter of fact.
You have. Travis hadn't. And he was stilled by the question. And then the tears began to stream down his face. And I believe he said he had never told anyone this, but when he saw himself in his dreams, he was free. There was no wheelchair. There was just an able-bodied person on ice with a stick doing what he loved to do.
All right. Now, the two youngsters that you got involved with, your dad tipped you off to this story.
Correct. My dad is an avid sports fan and had always been on the lookout for my next great sports story. And in 10 years, he had never successfully found it. But one day in 2009, he was in Cleveland reading the newspaper and called me in Connecticut, where I was based. And he brought my attention to a photograph in the Cleveland newspaper of two high school wrestling teammates. One of them was visually impaired, legally blind, and on his back in the photograph was his teammate, who was a double amputee. He had lost both of his legs when he was struck by a freight train at the age of 11. The two of them attended an impoverished school in Cleveland, Ohio, and because of the lack of consistent wheelchair access in their gym, D'Artagnan, the name of the visually impaired athlete, would carry his best friend Leroy on his back to and from their competitions, on and off the bus, and around the wherever they needed to go each day.
I always feel bad when I mean, some of these things happen strictly because of an accident that could have been prevented. And this happened to Leroy, believe it or not, at a rather interesting date of December 7th, 2001. And he got hit by a train.
Yes, the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. Yes, Leroy was 11 years old at the time. He was living, again, in an impoverished community in Akron, Ohio at the time. Father not involved in his life. Mother was working out of town. And young Leroy was just trying to take a shortcut to school as he walked. He was late. He was walking along some train tracks and sort of describes it as what you experience when you're driving on the highway next to a semi-trailer, how occasionally you've probably all felt the sort of that gravitational pull of the car to one side. And that's what Leroy experienced with the train. Even though it wasn't going terribly fast, he experienced a pull, slipped on the gravel, and his backpack got caught on the passing train. His legs were swept under and were severed by 13 rotations of the wheels before the train had passed over him and left him.
Now, you heard about this story from your dad.
Yes.
Tell me about Victor at ESPN. He was your guardian angel, I assume.
He was my manager in the features department at ESPN, and he's still there now as an executive with Disney Plus. And when I saw this photograph in the newspaper, there was a short article explaining that that afternoon was potentially the last wrestling match of their high school careers. It was sectionals, and if they didn't advance, that day would be their last wrestling match. And I was just really gripped by this photograph. Something in Leroy's eyes, in particular in the photograph, made me compelled me to want to find them and to just learn more about who they were and how life had brought them together and what could be learned from them. And normally when we pursue a feature story, there's a lot of planning that goes into it. We pre-interview subjects to see if they're comfortable, would be comfortable on television. We do budgets. We plan logistics. But sometimes, like this, there's an instance where it's now or never. And when I ran into work that morning with the picture and said, I really want to find them, and Victor hemmed and hawed and said, what's your gut feeling? And I looked at the photo and I said, Victor, this is the one who cannot see being carried by the one who cannot, the one who cannot walk being carried by the one who cannot see. We have never done a story like this before. And he just looked at me and he said, have a nice trip to Cleveland. And I had already packed a bag hoping he would say that. I raced to the airport, got on the next flight, and 5 hours later walked into their gym as they were warming up for their match. And as I started to approach them, their coach intercepted me. And when I extended my hand to introduce myself, he playfully slapped it away. And he was this larger-than-life 300-pound old-school coach. And he said, you know, we don't need to exchange pleasantries here. All we need to get clear is that you have been sent by God. So no pressure there, right?
Oh, absolutely. Let's get down to business.
Briefly went on to explain that every day he walked the track praying for his athletes. And he said, this year I've been praying hard for these two because they're seniors. And once they graduate, this world's got nothing for kids like these.
Now, if I remember correctly, it took 6 months to do this whole project.
Correct.
But it took a long time for both of these kids, as far as I can remember, to gain your trust and your confidence.
It took more time than a story subject usually would. Typically, we walk into a place and everyone's thrilled to be on ESPN and we'll sing like a canary.
I'm ready anytime if you want to.
Yeah. And D'Artagnan did. He was much quicker to open up. He was very excited to be on ESPN. He was a gifted wrestler and had sort of been waiting all his whole life for his moment to shine. And so it wasn't difficult to forge a relationship with him. But Leroy, the boy who had been hit by the train, was much harder. He had endured abandonment by his mother after his accident. He had, of course, his trauma. There were many traumas in his life growing up in the difficult neighborhoods he grew up in. So he wanted absolutely nothing to do with me when I first met him, and that was not a position I was used to. It took quite a while of sitting beside him in silence, of letting him know that I was more interested in a friendship with him than using him for television. It took many, many weeks before he would even share a pleasantry. But I understood, because he had experienced so much trauma in his young life that went untreated and unhealed. So many people that he trusted who walked out on him, that I could be patient with that process.
Well, besides not living in the best neighborhood, because the coach took you there the first time that you went, both of these kids did not exactly have a Cinderella lifestyle.
No, D'Artagnan's mother died of a brain aneurysm when he was 8 years old. He was the sixth of seven kids on her side of the family, but he had a different father from most of them and went to live with that father after his mother passed. His father battled drug and alcohol addiction, and for much of D'Artagnan's formative years, he was living alone in a crack house. They moved frequently, but always to other drug-infested areas. His dad battled mightily with those issues. His dad loved him very much, but wasn't able to provide any consistent support for him. He really found his refuge in sports. He found his brotherhood, his family, and his teammates. He found consistency. He found success. He often says if it weren't for sports, he never would have finished high school. Leroy, similarly, after his accident, his mother was ill-equipped to care for the depth of his needs and abandoned him for long stretches of time, leaving him alone with his younger sister. He also had to move every 6 months because of evictions. He went to 10 schools in 12 years, never once started in the beginning of a school year. So he suffered many traumas on top of losing his legs. And I was just amazed that these two boys, how their primary coping mechanism for their dire circumstances and their disabilities was not drugs, it was not gangs, it was not a sense of bitterness or entitlement. Their primary coping mechanism was a friendship. And that really stood out to me as special in urban teen culture. It was like their carrying of one another was also a symbol for the care that they shared. And that was the story that I wanted to tell.
How were they accepted by other students?
They were accepted quite well. D'Artagnan, as I said, was a top athlete in the school. And Leroy was very jovial with people. He had learned to put on his mask, which was a big, bright smile that assured people nothing was wrong, even though everything was wrong inside. But he made people, he made his peers comfortable with him. And the two of them were always joking around and singing. And they had magnetic personalities within the school.
But yet, which I find very strange, Leroy did not want to wear an artificial prosthesis.
Oh, no, he would have if he could. But he had one of his amputations is at the hip on the left side. And so in order to use prosthetic legs, he would need also a hip prosthesis, which we've looked into and had him assessed for. They're very cumbersome to use. They require, he would need a few surgeries, a year of intense training on it. And even then, you're not really walking with any ease. You're kind of ambling. And so he decided he was more comfortable staying in his chair. The prosthetic legs that he sometimes tried after his accident were sort of the base model that Medicare covers, and they're very uncomfortable for him and often cut into his skin. So it wasn't a realistic option for him. He wished he could use them, but his injuries are such that it doesn't lend themselves. Prosthetics don't lend themselves easily to it.
6 months to film this and put it together. And who came up with the title of Carry On?
That was all Tom Rinaldi. It was actually the first SportsCenter feature where a title was going to be necessary. Prior to that, we never named them. But right around this time when we were finishing our edit, we had decided I think the SportsCenter's graphic sets had changed, and there were now big plasma screens where you could have bigger introductory images and titles, and so we needed a title. And since I had never had to title something before, I kind of was panicked. And Tom said, well, I think it's obvious. Let's Carry On. And that was before Carry On was sort of trendy to be on everything in gift shops and T-shirts and all of that. And I just looked at their image, one on top of the other's back, and thought, that's it.
All right. So after this aired, I mean, these two kids eventually both went to college, but tell us how all that got started.
Sure. Well, my prayer throughout the filming was that someone would see this who had a big heart and some deep pocketbooks and could help their plight, both wanted to go to college. I wanted to get them out of poverty. I wanted to get them eating, you know, on a daily basis. I wanted to get them proper medical care. I just wished every day that I was with them that I could throw them in the car and say, follow me to a better life. And so Tom and I talked about it, and as a tagline to the piece coming out of it, he did something we never make pleas for money at ESPN. That would be unethical, but he just very simply wrote a line that said, both boys would like to attend college, but neither have the means to do so. It was just a factual statement, And we thought, well, let's see if anyone notices. Well, not only did somebody notice, but a couple thousand people noticed. And from the moment that piece went off the air, I averaged an email about every 2 minutes for the next week from people so moved by their friendship and wanting to give them the things in life that that they needed and deserved. And so very quickly, I had a family friend who was an attorney who helped me set up a trust fund for them. And within a week, $50,000 had come in, and which is a generous, wonderful amount of money, but it's still not enough to get two boys through college. And so there were three other viewers who wrote and said that they were in the position to fund their college educations individually on their own. And was I interested in that? So suddenly we went from having nothing, no opportunities, no hope, no funds, to having every opportunity and resource at our disposal. And it was literally like their lottery ticket had come in.
And did not ESPN ask you to cease and desist at one point?
Yes, I did get an email from our legal department saying that I could not collect funds for individuals. There are certainly legitimate ramifications that go with that. If I were to do so and funds were misused, then ESPN could be sued. Similarly, if future story subjects found out that money was raised for one person, well, then they may want something in exchange for telling their story. There's a lot of ethical reasons why that should not be done that I agree with. But in this case, this seemed like the only chance these two boys were going to have to get out of their environments. And so I talked to Victor, my boss, and was prepared to resign so that I could ethically do what these boys needed. And to Victor's credit and his soft heart, he just said, go take whatever time you need. Our little secret, go save the world. And interestingly, I've told this story at a conference I once spoke at, and a woman came up to me afterwards, and she said that she was the person who sent me the email at ESPN from the legal department 10 years ago. She was now in another job in another place, and she chuckled and said, I'm really glad you didn't listen to me.
Great for somebody to admit that.
I know.
All right. So, but these kids went to college, but it was not an easy road, even in college. I mean, they didn't just sail through.
Yeah, it was the wrong road in hindsight. Yeah, you know, I went through private school, and I naively thought that you graduate from high school and you are ready for college. I didn't understand the full scope of educational disparity in this country. And so even though D'Artagnan and Leroy had passed all their standardized tests and had, 3.0 grade point averages, they could not manage a single thing at a college level. They failed everything. They didn't know how to manage their schedule. They couldn't hold two nickels together. And when I had them further probed and tested, it turned out that they had eighth grade reading levels and fifth grade math levels. And they had just largely been passed through. They were nice kids. So here we are. I've got them in college. I have this team of supporters behind them, and learn that they are woefully unprepared for where we've just gone. And it was a shock to them as well. They thought they graduated from college. They were ready. And that was painful for them. And there was a lot of stubbornness and not understanding the scope of the support that they would need. And it was a lot of years of failure and trial and error before we could get them to a place where they could be self-sufficient.
But they both made it through.
Almost. We're not.
Okay, we're not through yet.
No, Leroy graduated from a video game production school in Arizona in 2013, and has been employed in the video game industry ever since, and is really liking that work. That was where he wanted to end up. D'Artagnan D'Artagnan took a longer path, but for good reason. One of the opportunities that came his way after the ESPN story aired was he was contacted by the U.S. Olympic Committee to try the sport of blind judo. I don't want to say it's an easy crossover from wrestling, but there's certainly skills that translate. And so he had the chance to move to Colorado Springs and live in the Olympic Training Center there from 2010 to 2016 when he retired, and he trained full-time in the sport of Paralympic judo. Just to differentiate, Olympics, able-bodied, Paralympics, physical disabilities, Special Olympics, more intellectual disabilities. So he trained alongside Olympic athletes. He traveled to the same World Championship events, to the London 2012 Games, to the Rio 2016 Games. And as his resilient, remarkable self, he earned bronze medals in London and in Rio and became a world champion in 2014. So he had an amazing, amazing experience, a safe, secure, structured environment in which to grow up and gain the life skills that he was missing, and went through to college part-time while he trained. He's now retired from judo, and he's in the final year of his sociology degree in Denver.
I seem to recall something in the book where he was told he had to win all these matches in England, because if he didn't, it would be all over.
He had to, that was a qualifying match to get to London. Yeah, he had to, he was still a baby in the sport. And even in on the Paralympic side, people had been doing this since childhood, and he was starting at the age of 18. But I have never seen a challenge that D'Artagnan backs down from. And so in 2 years' time, a year and a half, really, he was fighting to qualify for London and needed to win five matches in one day, and did it.
All right. Now, what made you decide to write the book?
Well, as I, let's see. So in getting Leroy, in helping Leroy and D'Artagnan become self-sufficient, in helping them acquire their missing life skills, deal with their traumas, develop coping mechanisms, navigate education, navigate medical care, the three of us grew so much, both individually and together. When I met them at ESPN and the money came in for them, I thought I was just going to sort of get them off into their new fairy tale lives and wave proudly from afar, and that was it. I didn't know the level of daily involvement that they were going to need to become successful. And they didn't have other adults in their lives who could fill that role. It was kind of me or nobody, and I'm glad it was me, because the three of us, as we worked through these daily challenges, failures, learning how to navigate adult responsibilities and customer service calls, the education system, the disability system, relationships, trauma, we really grew so close into what we call this unlikely family. You know, today Leroy calls me mom, and D'Artagnan and I have a mother-son type of relationship, and they are the two of the greatest blessings I've ever known. And we travel together quite a bit to speak at corporate events, at community events, at schools that adopt our book. And Leroy and D'Artagnan began to see that their pasts, the things that they always kept shrouded in shame, were also one of their greatest tools for connection, that if they were vulnerable about their experiences, if they were transparent, that other people that we spoke to were having their sort of Me Too moments. I thought it was just you who went through these things, but you're actually not alone. And they saw how their journeys inspired other people, and when we had the opportunity to write a book, I quickly said no, because I have great respect for authors who spend their lives writing, and I feel competent with television scripts, but book writing is a whole nother form. And Leroy and D'Artagnan were the ones who encouraged me to give it a try. And I realized if I had spent the last 8 or so years pushing them to do hard things well, pushing them to succeed in areas out of their comfort zone, well, how dare I not try? And they were a great support to me throughout the writing process. We learned our conversations as we rehashed their childhoods, and the research that I poured into it helped them fill in blank pieces in their memories, and we again grew even closer. So yeah, they were the encouragement, and their motivation was to encourage as many people as possible through what they survived, what they've overcome, and who they have become today.
Now, it seems to be the trend these days that many authors record their own books.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever realize when you were writing this book that you would have this opportunity?
I did not. I didn't even think about the audiobook piece of it until while I was writing. And when it was at the publisher was when I got, I mean, when it was being printed was when I got the email from my publisher saying, okay, let's move on to the next thing. Here's the offer, financial offer to record the book. And I said, yeah, that's a big no. I'm not doing that. In television, I produce people who are professional narrators, and I know well enough to know I don't have that voice. So I said, no, you can get a professional narrator to read it. And their next email came with 3 samples, audiobook samples of memoirs. Two memoirs were recorded by the author, and one was recorded by a narrator. And as I listened to all 3, I found that I quickly lost interest in the memoir that was narrated by a professional, because it wasn't the authentic voice of the journey. And that was what started to bring me around to the idea of recording it.
Mm-hmm. Now, after obvious question, after or during your sessions of recording the book,
yeah,
did you find anything where you said, "Ooh, maybe I should have said this, or maybe I should have said that"? I guess what I'm leading up to is, did it give you a closer look at the book, and were you 110% satisfied with what you wrote?
That was another reason I didn't want to record it, because I was afraid I would start finding things I wished were different, and it would have been too late at that point to change them. But I have to say, I was satisfied with it. And I think what helped my confidence grow about what was on the page was there were many passages where I would read it and the director was in my ear. I was recording in Boston, but the director was in New York.
Oh, wow.
And there would be many passages, pages I would read, and then I didn't hear anything. Like, he didn't say, okay, that's good, or give me any feedback, or tell me what to do over. And after a long pause, he would say, I'm sorry, I'm crying. And so I felt like, okay, if this was actually a good test, if I'm able to invoke that type of emotion to someone who's, I'm not even looking at, he's just listening, you know, in New York City, then I think we're going to be okay.
How long did it take you to do it?
Let's see. I recorded for, I think, 5 days, and they were 10, maybe 4 days, and they were 10-hour sessions.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, the book was 10 hours, so they couldn't have all been 10-hour sessions.
I think we recorded for about 40 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you would go back and redo stuff.
Oh, yeah. There'd be multiple reads of things. I would read a page and the director would say, try using inflection in this place, and or build your voice a little more in this to this point and then come back down. So he was a great coach. There wasn't a ton I had to redo, but Yeah, there were definitely points with multiple takes.
I'm definitely interested in this because I read talking books all the time. So, and I've had a chance to interview a couple of talking book readers. So I'm interested in somebody who does it, especially when it's their own book.
Yeah, I found the process fascinating. I went from being resistant to turning out that I loved doing it. And the kudos to the director because they have to listen painstakingly to every line and edit them together. So you don't read a whole chapter at once. You know, you'll read a section and then another section. And then the director will marry all those together and listen to it several times. And then I went back a month or so later to do some pickups, just places where I may have, you know, trailed off on the last syllable of something, or perhaps I started a section with an inflection that didn't match where the one before it ended. And so he listens for those nuances and you go back for one polishing session to correct those small things.
And you have two children of your own.
I also have a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old. Our 10-year-old we also adopted from Cleveland in 2009, the same time, the same area in which I met Leroy and D'Artagnan. And then 2 years later, I gave birth to our daughter.
Are you still active in ESPN now?
No, I'm not.
Or are you just being a full-time mother?
I got 4 kids in 2 years' time of different races, ages, cultures, and ability levels, and life needed to change pretty quickly.
Well, I must tell you, I admire you as a human being for what you have done and accomplished with these two young people. I admire you for anyone who can write a book, which you have done. And I admire you for your resilience and being able to read your own book and not having second. I just admire you for everything that you have done. And I thank you so much for coming in here and sitting down and doing this. And the name of the book again, which I will let you promote, is?
It's Carry On, a story of resilience, redemption, and an unlikely family.
Lisa, thank you so much for coming in here. And that will do it for this edition of City Talk. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening to another great conversation with Ken Meyer and friends. You can contact Ken by email. The address is kjmeyer7@gmail.com. That's kjmeyer7@gmail.com. Tune in next time for more conversation with Ken Meyer on City Talk.